KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
The reason why we are living in the era of the water protector, for sure, water protection, the defense of land, the defense of non-human species and relatives has existed since time immemorial, but there was something different about 2016, where anyone, not just indigenous people, could walk through the gates at the Ochete Shakowi camp in Standing Rock and become a water protector. It's a universal identity that's grounded in indigenous values. And we need support for those who have sacrificed their freedom, indigenous and non-indigenous.
In this episode, indigenous scholar and organizer Nick Estes explores how indigenous land-based and earth-centered societies are advancing regenerative solutions and campaigns to transform capitalism. And ancient economics today puts indigenous leadership at the forefront of assuring a habitable planet. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Indigenous Economics, Ancestors of the Future.
Today, I want to talk about what it means to be a water protector and why the identity of a water protector in this era of climate chaos is so important to a future on this planet, but also a different way of living with the Earth. And I think it's important to point out that while there's a lot of talk about how indigenous struggles are attached to the land and how we have an earth-centered and earth-based knowledge system, which is all true, there's often a tendency to not fully understand traditional economies. They're not historic, and so maybe traditional isn't the correct term, but maybe they're just land-based economies that aren't entirely capitalistic.
What do you do when you're trapped in a system where you don't belong? Sometimes the only way out is through. That's the predicament facing many indigenous communities, both in the U.S. and around the world. Capitalism is fundamentally in conflict with indigenous values, cultures, and life ways. It also appears to be in conflict with a habitable Earth. The climate emergency is the ultimate logic of a voraciously extractive paradigm that's also systematically unequal by design. Just as economics is driving the destruction, it needs to power the restoration, to transform the global economy from a vicious cycle to a virtuous cycle. Today, Native peoples are showing the world what it means to come together not only as protesters, but as protectors, peaceful guardians of the sacred sources of life and of justice. Indigenous peoples worldwide are linking networks to build power and engage millions more non-Native allies to build a just and regenerative economy and world. Nick Estes is Kulwi Chashwi Yate, a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux tribe. His nation is Ochete Shakowi Oyate, the Nation of the Seven Council Fires. He co-founded the nonprofit coalition Red Nation, which is dedicated to the liberation of Native people from capitalism and colonialism. Estes is also an author and founded Red Media to amplify Indigenous voices. He joined the University of Minnesota in 2022 as Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies. In 2021, he visited the No Line 3 water protector camps in Dakota and Anishinaabe territory. There he saw the catastrophic consequences of climate disruption and the fossil fuel economy on the tribe's sacred wild rice, called Manoman. Instead of a normal harvest of 80 pounds, the epic drought left just a cup and a half of this critical food for the community and their economy. Nick Estes spoke at a Bioneers conference.
Anishinaabe people have an esoteric spiritual connection to Manoman, which is codified within their 1855 treaty that actually protects the right of Manoman to exist. It's the only grain that is protected by treaty rights, by indigenous treaty rights, which isn't necessarily an aberration, because Article 11 of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, which was signed by my nation, the Ocheti Shalkoni, the Lakota Nation, and the Dakota Nations, also set aside territory for the continued perpetuation of the Pteoyate, or the Buffalo Nation, or the Buffalo people. And so even within these colonial treaties, these colonial laws, we inserted our rights of our relatives to exist and to continue to exist. We know today Western societies have adopted the rights of nature movement, and this is being attacked by the right as an anti-human and anti-life movement as well. And we can see the recent successes of certain countries like Ecuador and Bolivia in codifying it within their constitutional frameworks or within legal systems to protect Mother Earth or Pachamama.
Today, the rights of nature movement has become the fastest growing environmental movement in history. By 2022, 24 countries and 9 tribes had passed laws in the U.S. and Canada. It flips the capitalist paradigm from nature as property to be exploited to nature as rights-bearing to persist, evolve, and thrive. It's a fundamentally indigenous worldview, customized to modern times. It's no accident that First Peoples, who comprise just 3% of the world's population, continue to protect 80% of global biodiversity on indigenous lands. Yet everywhere, they're frozen out of economies. So how do you transform economics into economics? Start by looking to the past.
Where was the question of jobs when it came to the destruction of rice paddies? Where was the discussion of green jobs when it comes to land defense? Typically, jobs, as we know them in a capitalist system, is often workers in relationship to capital. And oftentimes, our jobs entail acts of pollution. And in the case of these pipelines, whether it was the Dakota Access Pipeline, the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, or the Line 3 pipeline, which was essentially a reroute of the Keystone XL pipeline carrying the same tar sands, the question of unionized labor always came to the fore, and the jobs that were going to be provided. And when these indigenous nations, whether at Standing Rock or whether at the Line 3 protests, decided to set up blockades and to say, these pipelines will not only destroy our water systems, but they will destroy our economies. Unionized pipeline workers crossed a picket line. What do we call people who cross picket lines? We call them scabs. And in this era of growing, intensifying, organized labor militancy, we have to understand that indigenous lifeways, indigenous protection of water, of air, of land, that very sustenance that we need to survive, should also be considered a form of labor that is valued and protected.
In other words, protecting and regenerating nature is a green job. Nick Estes cites a report by the Indigenous Environmental Network called Indigenous Resistance Against Carbon. It details the work of tribal nations, water protectors, land defenders, pipeline fighters, and many other grassroots networks who have dedicated their lives to defending the sacredness of Mother Earth. They're also protecting their inherent rights of indigenous sovereignty and self-determination. Indigenous peoples have developed highly effective campaigns that utilize a mix of nonviolent direct action, political lobbying, multimedia strategies, fossil fuel divestment, and other tactics to accomplish victories in the fight against neoliberal extractive projects, like Keystone XL and the Line 3 pipelines endangering the Minnesota waters and lands where Manoman grows.
That report found that indigenous-led movements from a variety of struggles, whether it was through direct action, court cases, legislation, were challenging about a quarter of greenhouse emissions from both Canada and the United States. In other words, indigenous people, a minority within both settler states, are punching well above their weight class in terms of impact on climate change and preventing cataclysmic climate catastrophe. To put that into perspective, that's about 400 new coal-fired power plants that are being challenged. And just the Line 3 pipeline alone is about 50 coal-fired power plants. So the completion of the Line 3 pipeline and the carbon emissions that it'll produce over its lifetime are about the equivalent of 50 coal-fired power plants. That's more than twice the carbon emissions of the entire state of Minnesota. I also want to turn to a recent backlash against water protectors and against the climate justice movement. There was a legislative initiative led by the American Legislative Exchange Council called the Energy Discrimination Elimination Act, which is model legislation that it's planned to go through state legislators to ban and to make illegal the divestment from fossil fuel companies as a form of energy discrimination. If you're challenging a quarter of greenhouse emissions from both Canada and the United States against one of the most violent and destructive industries in human history, of course there's going to be backlash. Of course there's going to be punishment and revenge against those who have hit the bottom line of this capitalist society.
Nick Estes says that when we think about capitalism, we also have to think about class. He spoke on a panel at a Bioneers conference.
Class isn't just about your income. Class is about power. It's fundamentally about power, and I think indigenous people are often removed from that question. And the massive genocide of indigenous people within this hemisphere, the largest genocide in human history that we know of, was a form of class warfare that not only destroyed entire nations of people, but destroyed entire alternative histories and possibilities of this particular land. And so we've been knocked off our course of development, and I think it's appropriate to not only challenge capitalism, but also move through it and work towards a different kind of system, and to understand that the culture and the values and the languages and the practices we still retain, the remnants of that, can be the basis of a new system and should be the basis of a new system. I think of Black Elk saying they cut down the tree of life, but the roots still remain. Like, indigenous lifeways are the roots of this land.
When we return, Nick Estes examines how the original DNA of capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism continues to evolve today with resource colonialism on indigenous lands, and how global indigenous movements are building allyship with all peoples to become protectors of life on Earth and ancestors of our future. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. This is Indigenous Economics. Ancestors of the Future. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. The so-called transition from feudalism to capitalism in Europe was in truth a blood-soaked 3 centuries of class war, privation, and grave inequality. Bankrupt monarchies and feudal manors became uneconomic. Feudal estates were sold to merchants to raise export crops as investments. Enclosure laws forced tenants off the land and privatized what had been the commons for an already precarious subsistence existence. It transformed landless peasants and workers into wage slaves. Money replaced nature as the preferred medium for the accumulation of wealth. Simultaneously came the conquest of the Americas. Colonization yielded the biggest transfer of wealth in history, a head-spinning 15-fold increase in Europe's money supply. Within a century, 95% of the indigenous populations of North America were dead. Then the elites began enslaving Africans. A new model had been set for an emerging global capitalist market economy. Export-oriented production, monopolistic wealth, and the international division of labor in a race to the bottom. It systematically destroyed local economies. With that model also came a worldview and ideology. The earth was a thing, commodity to be exploited for profit, and might made right. In 1493, a papal bull called the Doctrine of Discovery declared all non-Christian peoples less than human, with no rights. The church became business partners with the state, providing theological justification for land theft, genocide, and slavery. The Doctrine of Discovery has yet to be rescinded. Sometimes the only way out is through. But how? Again, Nick Estes.
Capitalism is neither inevitable nor is it natural to human society. We can look at all the human societies that have existed throughout time, the massive diversity, immense diversity of human, you know, culture, and understand that this is a minoritarian kind of like tendency that developed out of Western Europe that kind of spread to the rest of the planet, a great peril to many people, and now at great peril to everyone because of catastrophic climate change. When we talk about the invention of the steam engine in the early 1800s, or I guess the mass proliferation of the steam engine in industrial capitalism and the mills, the textile mills in England, that was a result of hand-picked cotton by an enslaved labor force on land that was stolen from indigenous people. And so when we think about the carbon, you know, emissions, the historical carbon emissions, it's fundamentally tied to those two processes. And that was only possible because of global capitalism, something we know as imperialism. Capitalism wasn't just an isolated thing that kind of started off in a small scale and then expanded. It was fundamentally a global system when it was inaugurated. And so I think to understand it that way opens up a new set of problems, but I think a new set of solutions as well. And looking at global supply chains, you know, we can even look at tribal nations. We can ask ourselves why a place like the Navajo Nation, which is essentially a state, you know, in terms of its size and population and how much resources that it holds in terms of coal, oil, and gas, as well as uranium. But why is it that that nation isn't as rich as all of the Chevrons or all of the Shell oil companies or all the energy companies that exist? It's because it's fundamentally resource colonialism. It's taking those places and purposefully impoverishing them so that they can take the raw material, develop it, and then sell it back to somebody else. We had moments in time where various kind of nationalist tribal councils in the Navajo Nation tried to essentially nationalize its oil industry and keep production within its boundaries, but that was attacked by the federal government to break that up in the interest of these energy corporations, because they don't want tribes to reap the profits of their very own resources that are on their land, let alone do they want developing nations or nations in the South to reap the profits from materials such as lithium, the new green energy frontier. And so capitalism is not the solution. It's the problem. We need to go beyond capitalism, but how we get there is another question. You can't wake up tomorrow, have good intentions, and then go and hug the murder out of capitalism. We have to move through this system, and we have to organize on all fronts. We have a new growing labor militancy that's attacking one of the most destructive, carbon-intensive industries, which is the Amazon monopoly on logistics. We should support unionization efforts. We should support unionization efforts and workers' democracy, because unions aren't environmentally bad. They often are, you know, pitted against environmentalists all the time. But there are examples, you know, going back to when the Black Hills Alliance allied with gold miners and ranchers in our homelands, people who would be ideologically considered settlers and colonizers, to say that treaty rights not only protect indigenous people and our access to the land, but they also protect workers who are working in hazardous conditions, who drink water that their mine tailings are polluting, right? We all drink the same water. Like, indigenous people aren't unique, and somehow, like, water that enters our body is, like, you know, something like that that's different. And so thinking about that and scaling up the idea of the local to the universal, and thinking that indigenous values protect everybody's access to clean drinking water, access to air, you know, access to land that we all need to survive. And so when we think about alternative systems, I would, you know, my tendency is towards socialism, but that requires organizing society to fight for something that's beneficial to everyone, not just our own interests as, you know, people who live in the United States, or not just our own interests even as indigenous people, but to understand that we are living at a very important, you know, time period where the things, the actions that we take right now are going to affect generations to come. And I think the most ethical action that we can take is to really fight like hell to build something that's different. And whatever that looks like, we have to find out through struggle itself. And the only way we win is if we struggle. And we can't be afraid to do that in this moment.
In 2020, the Red Nation nonprofit coalition that Nick Estes co-founded published The Red Deal. It describes a political program for the liberation that emerges from the oldest class struggle in the Americas, the fight by Native people to win sovereignty, autonomy, and dignity. It's a call to action, to come together, to confront climate catastrophe, and build a world where life can thrive. Nick Estes says the Red Deal was inspired by the 2010 People's Agreement of Cochabamba in Bolivia at the World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth.
We have things such as the Green New Deal. I think the sentiments behind such endeavors are important, but what the Cochabamba Accords, or the People's Accords, put forward is a critique not only of the patriarchal capitalist system that commodifies nature and that commodifies relations between humans and the non-human world, but also the uneven expectations of transition that are outsourced oftentimes to indigenous people and those people of the global South. That if global South countries, nations, and peoples developed along the same pathway as those in the United States and the so-called First World, we would need three planets to survive the immense amount of resources that it's going to take. And we can see that same mentality, that same system operating today. When the United States wants to make a one-to-one transition of energy consumption without understanding the extractive relationship it has to continue to consume. The lithium, the copper, the cobalt that goes into renewable technologies has to come from somewhere. Whether it was Biden, whether it was Trump, they understood that the key trading partner in that particular energy transition, the so-called Green Revolution, was China. And much like the fracking boom that began in 2008, which was an attempt to wean the United States off of what it considered conflict oil from countries that it was in disagreement with, the United States is again trying to develop its own strategic mineral reserve for green technology. Rather than questioning the mass consumption of energy in the first place, and we can see that indigenous peoples, again, are on the chopping block. Whether it's Resolution Copper in the sacred site of Oak Flat to build one of the world's largest copper mines to fill the needs of the so-called green energy revolution, or whether the massive open pit lithium mine that they're trying to build in Nevada, Thacker Pass, on sacred Northern Paiute lands, we understand that this relationship is still fundamentally colonial, and we need an alternative. And so that's why we're saying we need a people's agreement, not only amongst human nations and relations, but we need a people's agreement with the earth itself. And that we draw inspiration from Bevere Gwyn, or the idea that living and development in correct relations doesn't mean overconsumption, doesn't mean that we measure our successes on material consumption, but we measure our successes on the quality of life, not only of human beings, whether it's housing, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, or whether it's just living a good life, not at the expense of the planet. And we have models to draw from, as I pointed out with Bolivia, with Ecuador, but now there are growing models here in the United States. We have to go back to the water protectors. There's a reason why we are living in the era of the water protector. For sure, water protection, the defense of land, the defense of non-human species and relatives has existed since time immemorial, but there was something different about 2016, where anyone, not just indigenous people, could walk through the gates at the Ochete Shaconi camp in Standing Rock and become a water protector. It's a universal identity that's grounded in indigenous values. And we need support for those who have sacrificed their freedom, indigenous and non-indigenous. Over 900 water protectors in the Line 3 struggle are going through the court systems right now. And I want all of you to go online, to go to dropline3charges.com to donate, to find out how you can support a legal defense, because the most ethical thing that you can do right now is direct action to support those who are putting their bodies on the line. Because as my mentor and my relative, Madonna Thunderhawk, told me, that it's the highest honor of a Lakota person to be an ancestor of the future. And that's what we're asking you in this moment in time, to be good relatives of the future generations. So thank you very much.
Nick Estes, Indigenous Economics, Ancestors of the Future. Executive Producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior Producer and Station Relations Stephanie Welch. Program Engineer and Music Supervisor Emily Harris. Producer Teo Grossman. Host and Consulting Producer Neil Harvey. Production Assistants Anna Rubinova. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 253.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
The Donegal Railway was built to transport herring from Burton Port to Derry. It ran from the sea into the hills where the winds shriek up from the dark Atlantic and rage over the bog. Woolen fleeces straight off the backs of sheep were laid down in the muck to make its foundations, taming the thick murk of that haunted place, so it rattled with 20-ton locomotives. The tracks passed through the chalky rock, and viaducts carried them over streams leaching tannin-rich waters that run brown, skitting with dragonflies, and spill off the mountains to the sea, where fishermen, in Orly Ganzi's motored steam trawlers that whipped herring up and out of the water by the power of mechanical winches, filleted, barrelled, stacked and shunted over the bog where wild winds blow. The bog is an alchemical place, an animate world of beings that continue to exist even as they decay, slow rotting heaps of mosses and ferns full of the skulls of sheep that fall into its drains and the roots of oak trees petrified and latticed beneath its strata, spirits of Ireland's ancient woodland. And the iron railway sliced them up and rested on wooden sleepers and gravel beds quarried from the hills. The bog is an ocean of life-making elements that cycle through the bodies of fish and birds and the wild orchids that burn into soot in the steam engines of the railway and are carried off on the screaming wind. These are forces made in the stars, the sun heaving with flares and explosions. At night, in the bog, primordial gases take fire from rotting peat and glow in a thin fog that lies between this world and the one beneath. The will-o'-the-wisp, fairy lights dancing their way into being. The headlamp of the steam train cuts through the myth of the bog like a knife. That life force which comes down from the sun courses through the alder and the birch and the mackerel and herring that swarm the sea. The herring came to the northwest corner of Ireland in shoals that ran silver and heaved through the sea, such force in their numbers that they coursed through the water in a great shining wave. They were hunted to annihilation, silver turned grey in the dry air and the lustre of the sea was gone. When the herring stalks crashed, the railway closed and the bog fell silent, apart from the harrowing wind. Few in living memory have seen the herring, and even fewer have known the will-o'-the-wisp, or the fairies, or the ancient trees. They are all assigned to the place of myth which lies just beneath the surface of the bright earth. The railway embankment still cuts through the hills, and I take my bicycle here on trips to visit Dad, rattling across the bog, bracing against headwinds that roll up and shriek from the sea. I pass a wind-blown hawthorn and the place we used to dig for turf, heaving it out from the ground with narrow spades, stacking dark lumps of fossil earth to be dried and burned on the hearth. Dragonflies dart among purple heather and wild orchids, a kestrel wheels towards heaven and a hare creeps up from the other world. I follow a dark churning stream full of trout down to the graveyard, where Dad lies at the foot of an ash tree that stirs in the breeze. And I place on his grave a bunch of fuchsia, crimson and pink like salmon, gathered along the side of the road. In Dad's last winter, he couldn't lift the turf basket, and I carried it to the house. He set the fire each morning, twisting the paper and laying the kindling that I reduced with the hatchet from blocks of oak and ash. The turf packed down tight, its scent carried out on the drizzle, a ghost of the bog. We used to follow the railway up to the mountain lochs, finding bones and clay pipes and bits of coal along the tracks. We passed the hawthorn and the dark tannin streams that run down to the sea and turn it black as soot. We caught fish in their waters and watched the silver sparks fade, shimmering off someplace else from our cold hands. It's late in the evening when I ride down home from the railway embankment. You shouldn't be out on the bog much later. There is a chill in the empty house, and I light the fire and watch the flames spark bright like the shining sea when the sun dips beneath it to another world. The wind has gone silent, and my woolen socks hang, soaked through and stinking, above the hearth.
Look at the bog as the place just lies dead. Nothing to do for the body, nothing to do for the head. Take me where the heather and the moss grows.
Many years ago, a young reporter from the Tipperary Star approached the Irish Press agriculture correspondent, Maurice Liston, at the Thurles Agricultural Show and asked him what it was like working for the Irish Press. Liston quietly put down his glass of whisky to respond. Son, the Irish Press is like a three-ring circus, and I would be like a trapeze artist in that circus, going swing, swong, swing, swong, and there's always some little so-and-so there ready to grease the bar. One morning in 1983, I learned for myself what he meant when I found myself in the forecourts reporting for the Irish Press sister paper, The Evening Press. I was up against a deadline to file copy on the sentencing of a high-profile drug dealer in the Central Criminal Court. To my astonishment, I was refused use of the High Court press phone in the forecourts by a disobliging colleague. High Court reporters only, he told me. I was left with no choice but to hurry past the guilty party's distraught family and friends and grab the public phone in the echoing round hall at the entrance to the forecourts. After fumbling for change and pressing the old button A, I got onto a copy taker and dictated as compelling a lead story as I could manage for the Evening Press without being overheard by the family outside the phone box. Nerve-wracking or what? When I put down the phone, I breathed a sigh of relief. Another lead story landed in the cross-liffy war of words with the Evening Herald. In the days before the mobile phone, what we now call the landline was all important for a newspaper reporter. Later that same year, on a dark, foggy night, I stumbled out of the bog near the scene of the tragic Cherryville train crash, which claimed 7 lives and injured over 50 passengers. I made a dash to the first house I could find in that lonely corner of Kildare. Without thinking twice about it, I knocked loudly on the front door, waking everyone up. I explained my plight and was ushered politely to the shiny black instrument on the hall table. The sleep-deprived family sat and listened as I dictated my story over the phone to a newsroom in Dublin, which was filling up with colleagues summoned to cover the unfolding tragedy in the kind of detail that the Irish Press was known for. That noisy, open-plan newsroom on Burr Quay, looking out over the Liffey, was the centre of my universe. It was littered with industrial-strength typewriters, rolls of copy paper, phone lines dropping from the ceiling, caffeine-stained mugs, half-eaten sandwiches, and overflowing ashtrays. It was just the place to be when a big story broke, like the kidnap of Jennifer Guinness by an armed gang demanding a ransom of £2 million. In my search for a story, I did get a few words with her breadman on a trip to her home in Howth, but nothing more until a midnight phone call to my flat on Pembroke Road alerted me to the fact that Mrs. Guinness had been found alive and well in a house on nearby Waterloo Road. I dashed around to find the Gardaí putting up barriers to close off the road. So, being young and enthusiastic, I climbed a wall and made my way up through the gardens until I was opposite the house where she was being held. In the interests of our readers, I crawled under a car to get within earshot of the negotiations and settled down with notebook in hand. To the surprise of the Gardaí, I emerged from hiding at dawn, just in time to witness Mrs. Guinness, later much praised for her bravery through her ordeal, coming down the steps, looking in reasonable spirits, and her captors being led away. I walked down Waterloo Road towards the barriers, very pleased with my night's work. After all that effort, I was not very happy to see my hard-won scoop relegated to page 2 of the Evening Press, but it still made a good yarn to tell later in the day in the office annex better known as Mulligan's of Poolbeg Street. When I joined the Irish Press in the 80s, the group was selling 1.7 million newspapers every week, and when it closed in 1995, that figure had dropped off by a million. Some 600 people lost their jobs. Many found refuge elsewhere in the media, but some never worked again. I left 6 years before the closure, but on every visit back to Dublin, I would make a beeline for Mulligan's to catch up with the trapeze artists of Burgh Quay. The great sports writer Con Houlihan thought of the Irish Press as more of a village than a circus. 30 years after the last newspaper appeared on May 25th, 1995, the memories linger on, but sadly, Con's village is well and truly deserted.
You. What poems are coming up on the junior and the leaving? And this is where it started. I'm in our local supermarket in Fingus, and one of me ma's pals, Mrs. Buckley, thinks I might have some inside info on the state exams. She has one child doing the junior and another doing the leaving. Word had gone around our estate. The youngest Heggo girl is doing a master's in poetry at Trinity. Poetry? I ask you. But it's exam season, and the parents of Finglas examinees are just as desperate for help as any. Poetry. Turns out the Finglas Heggo girl might be good for something. I tell Mrs. Buckley the truth. I've no idea what poems are coming up on the junior or the leaving. Her face looks crestfallen, so I offer to do a free grind on the elements of poetry. Come here, you! What poems are coming up on the junior and the leaving? And so began my now 20-year habit of offering free poetry grinds of a June bank holiday. Since then, I've had a day with any and every leaving or junior certer who wants to stall by and get a free grind. And by Jesus they come. Cars pull up outside our house in Raheny and parents march kids up to our doorstep. Our garden wall becomes a bike rack for those kids brave enough to knock on the door themselves. The dog barks and then wags her tail as teenager after teenager gets a welcome through the hall door and into the kitchen. When it comes to teenagers, trough, as we call it in my house, is the key. My older nieces and nephews were enticed to come get the poetry grind by a promise of chocolate pancakes. I learned that trick from me ma and da. With kids, it's best to feed first and they'll talk later. So everybody is offered a cuppa and some pancakes. And then we get down to talking about the elements of poetry. Form, metre, images, symbols, line end rhymes, internal chimes, half rhymes, and how a whole world of wonder is possible when words are crafted into a poem. For those who can't be bothered with poetry, I ask them to tell me the name of their favourite song in the charts. We look up the lyrics. Lo and behold, even Stormzy uses metre. Form, images, symbols, line end rhymes, internal chimes and half rhymes. Our eldest son did his junior cert in 2019. And he insisted that himself and his best mate get their own private grind on account of the scarlet for your ma factor. I was fool enough to ask him why he's morto of his ma, and the look he gave me reminded me of the look I'm sure I once gave me own mother. But I relented and gave the eldest and his best pal a private lesson before I did two sessions of the free poetry grinds. That year, we had 10 junior certers in the morning and 12 leaving certers in the afternoon. Word had spread among the Mammy Mafia, and there were even a couple of kids from the south side. Come here, you! What poems are coming up on the junior and leaving certs? I still don't know. But I know a poem has form, metre, images, symbols, line end rhymes, internal chimes, half rhymes, and a word glimpse of wonder. The first Wednesday after the June bank holiday and the exams begin. Good luck to all the leaving certers and junior certers. And good luck to the families and all.
On Raglan Road, of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue.
I pushed the buggy along the Oldbourne Road in the fog, adjusted the plastic hood to protect my youngest daughter, age one, all cozied up and asleep. 3-year-old Shell was holding onto the handle. Are you okay? Not too tired? You can stand up on the buggy if you like. Her dark curls danced as she shook her head. No, I can walk. But her face was pale as we turned right for Bournebrina and on up the hill. My damaged knee objecting to the hill as flying birds turned silver against the purple and moss green mountains up ahead. Our GP, a countryman, had said that he didn't want to prescribe more antibiotics for the children and that there was this paediatric nurse in Bournebrina doing something that seemed to work. Like what? I'm not sure, he said, but you give it a go. We found her house and her husband Michael's garden centre across from the small church, and a black cat with sleek and incredibly shiny fur eyed us when we knocked on the front door. Come in, come in. A slight dark-haired woman beckoned us inside. The house smelt of lavender, herbs and spices, and I felt reassured as we followed her into the front room. I was nervous and started to babble about all the things I was depressed about. The children are getting too many chest infections. I'm working with the local Earthwatch, and there's so much pollution it would make you cry. And I teach dancing, but I can't just now because of my knee, and so I've been going door to door with a petition to stop them burning the rainforests. And one guy said, are you one of those tree huggers? And then he saw me going into Centra and shouted over, are you going in there for brown rice, love? I mean, you don't need to be a hippie to care about what kind of earth we leave for the children. How marvellous, she interrupted. Brown rice is one of the best things you could eat. And I didn't even know about a local Earthwatch. You'll have to tell me all about it. Now, this is my chair, especially for mothers, because they never get a minute to put their feet up. I looked behind me at the lounging chair covered in soft blue blankets with patchwork cushions. You relax. And children, come. She led them to the windowsill and scooped up a handful of colourful crystals. Look, she said, like Aladdin opening the cave. Pick out your favourite and you can take it home. She came back to me then with a brown glass bottle, pouring some of the oil into her hand to anoint my forehead and wrists with roses and lavender. I lay back into the arms of the comfy chair, noting the way she had quietened me so she could work. She busied herself at a table and I looked around properly. Coloured silks on the plinth, big books open on the sofa and the table, diagrams of the body and the meridians. I remember seeing the word microbiome and reading about the way microbes in our bodies were connected with the microbes in the clay, and beautiful photographs of flowers, herbs and trees. Patricia and Michael were years ahead of their time. We were there for 2 hours. She traced the meridian from the ugly rash on my neck to my swollen knee, and our bodies told her everything. We left with oils for foot baths, remedies, a bar of carob to replace my chocolate addiction, and a loaf of banana bread. These are your healers, she said. Clean water, clean air, clean food from good earth and sunlight, it will take time. But I already felt healed. I already felt hope. We walked across the road to explore the small church. The children were unusually quiet in the hushed interior, winter sun coming through stained glass, the jewel colours falling upon us. Every night, I filled basins for foot baths with aromatic oils, and my daughters slept deeply and well, their breathing soft, clean and clear. I was in my early 20s, and my life was about to change in ways I never could have imagined. Somehow it was all connected. The woman in Bornabrina, the scent of herbs and flowers, coloured light and our bodies telling her, telling her. You see, I thought I was saving the earth, but the earth was saving me.
On the roadside the other day, I watched a man stand on a trailer and tramp down hedge clippings. And our old workhorse, Paddy, came to mind. Paddy, barrel-bellied, big as the Trojan horse, standing on a silage pit, indifferent as eternity. When I was growing up, silage was a new invention, new to Ireland anyway, but it was catching on. Haymaking may have been romantic while the weather held up, the smell of clover in the meadow, but if the weather broke, the gods of the sky were merciless. Showers from the west turned the hay yellow, then grey, then black, useless. Silage was the answer, a kind of fodder farmers could make themselves from fermented, compacted grass. We had an uneven field made of rolling hillocks, so that all we had to do to construct a silage pit was excavate the earth between two adjacent hillocks, and into the space created, we could toss grass hauled from faraway fields. Some farmers took readily to silage making. Others squinted at the operation from over ditches, suspicious. A neighbour of ours, for example, Bat Breen. Bat had a derogatory name for silage, spinach. The summer of 1958 brought rains which would have floated Noah's Ark. Bat looked out his window one day that was sunny and cut the meadow for hay. It rained on his sunshine crop. He shook it up with his hay tether to make it dry and sweet again. It rained again. He tedded again. It rained again. With his fork, he tossed the sward to let wind and sun into it. It rained again until finally he burst from his farmyard and shouted to all and sundry, "I fooled ye. It was dung, not hay, I wanted to make." But instead of making dung, that could have made silage. Our silage-making operation went like this. My older brother cut the sward with the hay mower, then loaded it into the trailer with the green crop loader. This was before the now familiar silage harvester, the one with the chute like a chimney crossing the fields. As each load was dumped into the pit, the mound grew. My sisters, brothers and I were ordered to tramp it. We jumped on it, fooled around, threw it at one another, grass down our shirts into our Wellingtons, until the grown-ups decided we were too lightweight for tramping and bulkier infantry was required. "Harness the horse," Father ordered. Paddy, our old Irish draft horse, retired to the haggard, dreaming, blowing wind, no good for anything, a neighbour said. except to sweeten the rhubarb with his droppings. Placid chestnut haulage engine until the grey Ferguson took over. Paddy was out of practice. He, who during the war years, the emergency, the compulsory tillage years, had ploughed rough ground. The bridle was thrown over Paddy's head. He gobbled at the bit in his gummy mouth. I got the job of leading him round and round the hump of mown grass, sunrise, sunset. Paddy might well have asked, why do I need to be dragged out of retirement for this needless drudgery? Well, Paddy, because we need to make space in the pit for 20 acres of meadow grass. But of greater importance, we need to compact the crop and squeeze the air out of it and so keep down the temperature in the pit. Silage pits have been known to self-combust when overheated, Paddy. Do you get that? Can you feel the heat beneath your hoofs? Keep tramping, old trooper. Paddy would have stood stock still on that pit if allowed. I'd have to allow him a nibble of grass sometimes, though. Talk in his ear and dry his sweat-lathered neck. But the day that he stood on my flimsy Wellington clad foot, he truly fell asleep on the job. I roared, I bawled, I jerked his halter. I'd have kicked his leg had I a leg to stand on. I grabbed at the tuft of hair around his hoof, his elephant hoof. It wouldn't lift. The following year, it was the tractor that drove up and around the pit, compressing the grass efficiently to cool it down. But in 1958, the year I tramped with Paddy and afterwards returned to school with a foot too sprained to play football until Halloween, we produced, Paddy and me, not spinach, not dung, but pickled grass, silage. Later that year, he passed away. I was 10. He was 25. A veteran of the war. Salute him.
When I was young, never saw the truth hanging from the door.
Ag dul fui éan an bhainne. Aum tí an tráth nóna ag amacht, héin fui éan an bhainne. Fi a clap holas na hí ag bagart, agus fui mar a bhóchtar sáid se na hárclana, dair ria gachra dorracha i braba na súl. Ik pjukke chémenne trí éalach na mó, chean a bhóthar bhaile na ngáil, a grapping an cnoch. An canteen stáin á luasca gom, an lán a garad i gairí níos fuide. Cruata na hóige ina lí go traum, go dí go mwinhing doras bánaí ártig amach. Istíg fui dhéan an tí, decking í ina si ag bóard mór ferma. Tá riach si. A adas a bhíoch a cat ag fara iri ó fhéirse. Thiúlach si go dtí an bocéad bainne, bhuinneach si an muslín de, cáithníní ar snáb is solas lé na cistena, bhímis le chéile sa tolán. Lena ladar miotal ghrutach si an bainne stacha me cheantín, agus mar chríoch chuireach si bréant an chat i stachán. Thugaing an scileng dí an sin agus chasing a bhaile. Going for the milk. Tea time, getting late in the evening, I'd go for the milk. Night would be just about to fall, and the way lights are suddenly snuffed out in a theatre, everything used to go pitch dark in the wink of an eye. Picking my steps through the cow dung on the old road of Ballinangowl, I'd climb the hill, the tin canteen swinging, the short lane getting longer, the hardship of youth lying heavily until I'd reached the doorway of Ben Iartig. Inside, under the thatch roof, I'd see her sitting at a big farm table. She'd get up, her cat watching her from its perch. She'd walk to the bucket of milk, remove the muslin covering it, dust motes floating in the dim light. We were in a tunnel.